Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, this week, a circuit court judge ruled schools can still require students to wear masks. More than a dozen Florida districts are already doing just that. This as the state appeals that judge's decision, striking down Governor Ron DeSantis' effort to ban mask mandates at school. But here's the bottom line, everyone. At least for now, masks are staying on in the 13 Florida school districts that require kids to wear face coverings to slow the spread of COVID-19.
Now, the next stop for the court case is the First District Court of Appeals in Tallahassee. Governor Ron DeSantis argues the decision if a child should wear a mask or not in school is not a decision by school officials, but rather should be a choice of parents. His argument rests on a law that legislators approved this past spring and he signed in late June. The Parents' Bill of Rights gives parents the, quote, fundamental right to direct the upbringing, education, and health care of their children, end quote. This law allows the government to make decisions if there is a compelling reason.
We begin the hour at a closer look at all of this. Where is the balance between parents' rights and protecting students in school during a deadly pandemic? Let us know your thoughts, Florida. Call us up right now statewide. The number to join the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Tweet us at Florida Roundup.
Republican Representative Cord Byrd represents the 11th District of Florida in Duval and Nassau counties. He is a co-sponsor of the Parents' Bill of Rights. Representative, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you.
Do you believe that school districts with mask requirements now are breaking state law in Florida?
I do. They are violating the Parents' Bill of Rights.
And how are they violating the Parents' Bill of Rights, in your opinion?
Sure. Because it was clear, and let me make clear for the listeners that the Parental Bill of Rights did not come up in response to the pandemic last year. This has been something that Representative Grawl, who was the primary sponsor of the bill, has been working on for years. And the reason is that parents don't co-parent with school districts. Parents direct the health, well-being, and education of their children, and we wanted to make that very clear. And that was the purpose of the Parental Bill of Rights. We wanted to give parents the right to direct that, not school boards. And I am confident that Judge Cooper's ruling will be overturned by the first DCA.
This is Judge John Cooper, the Leon County Circuit Court judge, that threw out the governor's ban on school mask mandates. He said that the state was relying on only part of the law's language regarding parents' rights over their child's health care, but ignoring the additional part of the law that allows government to make decisions if there is a compelling interest and if the action is narrowly tailored. Is the governor, representative, trying to enforce just part of the Parent Bill of Rights?
No, not at all. He's giving parents the option. If you want your child to wear a mask, you have the right as a parent to direct that. If you don't want your child to wear a mask, you have the right to direct that. And I listened to Judge Cooper when he made his initial oral ruling. And he, quite frankly, he misinterpreted the law. He didn't apply the correct legal standard. And I can say that having been a practicing lawyer in Florida for the last 25 years.
Yeah. So what part
which is why I'm so confident that he will be overturned.
Yeah. Apologies for the interruption there, Representative. What part is he misinterpreting in your estimation? In his court order, he wrote that, quote, in plain English, this law says the government cannot interfere with parental rights regarding education and health care unless there's a reasonable basis to do so.
Right. So that we put in a strict scrutiny standard and he applied a reasonableness standard. So he just cherry picked the word reasonable and applied that. But if you look in section 1014.03, that's a strict scrutiny standard, which is what he should have applied and did not.
So you think that the judge is using the wrong kind of measuring stick here. The law does allow for this compelling interest for the state to act in response to a compelling interest. And if that action is, quote, narrowly tailored. Do you believe that the pandemic is a compelling interest for a government agency to act?
I do. But here's what I think a lot of people are missing. There are two U.S. Supreme Court cases, the Jacobson opinion from 1905, I believe, and the Prince opinion from 1944. And in both of those cases, people have argued, well, that gives states the authority to mandate healthcare treatment during a pandemic. In the 1904 case, it was specifically a vaccine, and that's mm-hmm. true. But the part of the cases that everyone is missing is that it's the state legislatures that get to decide whether to do it or not do it. We acted under the Parental Bill of Rights. It is not school boards in Florida who get to decide that. It is the state legislature, which we did.
You're saying
which
the state, we have. Sorry, for the for clarification, you're saying that it's the compelling interest language in the law only refers to the compelling interest that the legislature can act, not any other local government agency in Florida can act.
Correct.
So the school districts, regardless of what the compelling interest may be, a local government would have no ability to act and to create a narrowly tailored response for healthcare or education or the well-being of children in Florida.
There are some areas in which the school boards within their constitutional and legal authority can act. But in this instance, it is the state legislatures that have the constitutional authority to act. And that is what the governor is enforcing and what the school boards are violating.
What would be considered an example of a compelling interest under this law, in your opinion, Representative?
So under the Parental Bill of Rights?
Correct, yes.
I think we would need something with, you know, you're asking me a hypothetical. And it's difficult
sure.
to come up with a medical hypothetical, but the current situation with the masks, and I'll use this example, England. England has had much more severe lockdowns. They've had much stricter mandates. England does not mandate masks for their children. We've looked at not only school districts.
Just to be clear, sorry.
Just
to be clear, Representative, the United States does not mandate masks.
Yeah. And the evidence is not clear that they're performing with those who are mandating them say that they do.
So I apologize for the interruption there, Representative. You're comparing the United Kingdom, which is a federal national government. The United States does not mandate masks either as a national federal interest.
Well,
neither does the state government.
I'm sure that's coming soon after what the president said yesterday. But
you're referring to the vaccine requirement that the president and OSHA is putting in place for employers.
He also mandated doubling the fines for mask violations for air travel. So he did include masks yesterday.
That's true. Masks are required on public transportation, including airplanes in the United States. Representative,
right, the
we have
point,
to leave it there.
The point you at the question you asked me was about the compelling state interest.
Correct. And if you could give us an example of what that compelling state interest would be under the Parental Bill of Rights.
Apparently, I'm not going to be able to speak. My point in bringing up the UK is that we as a state can look at evidence from other countries, districts around Florida, and what other states have done. And we do not see the evidence that masking children prevents the harm that the school districts claim that it does.
Representative, appreciate your words. I gave you an opportunity to speak. I was simply providing clarification for your answer. Representative Cord Byrd is the Republican representative from District 11 in Northeast Florida, co-sponsor of the Parents' Bill of Rights. Representative, thanks again for your time.
Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Well, as the mask case continues in court, the state already has held back money from two school districts over their mask mandates. The money is equal to the salaries of school board members. But this week, the U.S. Department of Education announced a grant program for districts that are being penalized for mask rules. It's called Project Safe. Last night, in a national address, President Joe Biden said governors withholding funds from districts mandating masks are, in his words, bullies. Right now, we welcome Carly Simon, superintendent of the Alachua County Public Schools, and Craig Wisenhunt, a Florida attorney representing parents in the mask lawsuit. Good to have you both on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment. Florida, 305-995-1800. Carly Simon, let's begin with you. Will the Alachua County Schools seek this Project Safe grant money from the Department of Education to make up for the money you would theoretically be losing from the state over your mask mandate?
Yes, we intend to apply for the Project Safe option. We're very pleased with this option because we were concerned of how we would actually acquire the funding if it had to go through the state before it ended up going through the U.S. Department of Ed. So we appreciate this additional path.
How is the mandate going in your district right now? Are any parents opting out, bringing in a doctor's note? What's the compliance like?
We do have parents who have been submitting medical opt-out forms, and it's well below 100. I believe we're over 50, but probably more in the 60s. We have had a few parents who've participated in the HOPE Scholarship. So those are our two programs that we are offering as opt-outs. As far as compliance, I mean, we do have board meetings and we receive emails where people are not happy about the policy. But as far as in our school buildings, I'd say most of the students are participating and following the mask mandate policy, and it's helping us. We now actually have less than 1,000 students quarantined, and that's the first that we've had since the school year began. And I think a big part of that is because we are reducing our transmission of the virus and we are able to have face-to-face instruction.
So you have,
and we have stayed open.
You've stayed open, and you said you've based your decision on masking on the science. You're confident then that you'll see positive rates go down with universal masking?
We're feeling that we are doing everything that we can to reduce the transmission, and the masking is one of the tools that we are using. We also are encouraging vaccinations for students and for staff members. We have vaccination clinics. We are also, you know, hygiene as far as washing hands. We're doing everything that we can, and we have had districts in the state that had to close because of the transmission, and I'm proud to say that we are still open and we are able to have this instruction. And like I said, our quarantine rates are below 1,000, which is great because when they're not in school, we're not having that face-to-face experience.
Craig Wisenhunt, you're representing Florida parents. You've said we don't live in a monarchy or a dictatorship. You must be pleased about this ruling, but the governor says he does expect it to be reversed on appeal. He filed an emergency appeal through his attorneys this week. What's your response to that?
Well, I think the governor is pandering to a small portion of his political base with the, you know, false hopes of ultimately succeeding on what is ultimately an incredibly simple issue. The plain language of the statute as written makes it clear that school boards have the authority to do this. And even if it didn't, the Florida State Constitution establishes that school boards get the authority from the Constitution to operate and control their schools. And no matter what the legislature wants to believe of itself, it can pass no law that compromises a constitutional grant of authority. If that would require a constitutional amendment, I'm sure Representative Byrd just had forgotten that after his 25 years of legal practice, but the legislature doesn't have that authority.
What did you think of Representative Cord Byrd's remark that he said he didn't believe any government other than the state government could find a compelling interest to make health care decisions for kids under Florida's Parents' Bill of Rights?
Well, I found it shocking, particularly given that Representative Byrd has taken great pride in being a co-sponsor of a bill he must not have read, because in the language of Florida Statute 1014.03, it says the state, any of its political subdivisions, any other governmental entity, or any other institution can infringe upon the rights of this bill if there's a compelling interest. So I find it shocking he thinks that somehow the legislature is exclusive in this right, when they made it very clear in the plain language they chose to include all of the other political entities and government levels in Florida.
We're going to go to some calls now here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Lots of people calling. Let's begin with Brad. Brad in Fesner, Florida. Hi, Brad. Is that where you're located?
Yeah. Go ahead. Fesner, Florida, Hillsborough County. So I received an email from my kid's school. He's 5 years old, has Down syndrome, DSE. They implemented the mask mandate on August 18th. August 20th, we saw the greatest number of staff and students impacted at 13,485 cases. Now, this is directly from Hillsborough County Schools. Since we implemented that mask mandate September 8th, it was a 58% decrease to 5,647 students and staff from August 20th. The mask mandate, mask work, this politicization of the mask by Representative Burr or whatever his name is pandering to a small group, and that just happens to be the loudest group. They're getting smaller and smaller. It's just hurting more and more every time people go out without a mask. So mask up and get vaccinated. It's working, and if they want to compare to other countries like United Kingdom, let's go with universal health care like they have too. Maybe that'll be beneficial for us as well.
Brad, thanks for your thoughts. Carly Simon, certainly you and other superintendents who have mandated masks are going to be closely watching the data. We are hearing that from Hillsborough County, that they are seeing a decrease with masking. We'll be following this data, too. Are you in conversation with other school superintendents that are in your shoes and are keeping tabs on this?
Yes, we actually have a nice group of superintendents who come together, and we talk about similar interests, so the ones who are, you know, as well doing a mandatory masking, but we also have discussions with superintendents who are choosing to do an opt-out option with the parent notes. We have a lot of discussions because I think we're all in new territory and we want to make sure that we can deliver the face-to-face instruction and we want to track our data. We have some serious concerns about comparing data because we have a very robust dashboard where we're collecting the information and trying to document it and share it with the community, but not all districts are doing this. So it's hard for us to look at it. And even at like a county data level, one of my frustrations is that it would be nice to know the pediatric positivity rate across the state for all counties, because right now it's hard to understand how we compare to other districts. But I'd say just as far as, you know, feeling the impact, we are seeing the benefit of having the masks in our schools because we are seeing a reduction in our transmission. And the goal is to continue to run our education system and have this face-to-face instruction. And so we're very positive and happy about the results that we're seeing.
Superintendent, let's hear from somebody in your neighborhood, maybe. In Gainesville, Patty is calling here the Florida Roundup on Line 8. Patty, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I've never called in before, but after listening to the representative, I'm just furious because parents do have the responsibility for their children's health. I agree with that completely. If they choose to not have their child wear a mask, then they should keep the child home without a mask and allow the rest of the children and teachers and workers in schools to be safe from a deadly pandemic. And that was just my comment.
Well, Patty, appreciate that you felt compelled to call. Thank you very much for listening to public radio there in Gainesville and joining us here on the Florida Roundup.
And I want to thank Carly Simon, superintendent in Alachua County Schools, and attorney Craig Wisenhunt. Thank you both so much for being with us and sharing the latest on this. We'll keep following it.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you so much.
A quick break, and up next, could Florida pass a restrictive abortion law like the new one in Texas? That's coming up. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Florida lawmakers likely will consider new abortion restrictions in the weeks ahead as committee meetings in Tallahassee begin ahead of the next legislative session. And a big focus is going to fall on a Texas-style abortion law. Now, a new law that took effect at the beginning of this month in Texas bans most abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected, much earlier than any other abortion restrictions. It does not include exemptions in cases of rape or incest. The law also has private citizens being able to sue anyone involved in an abortion, allowing them to collect at least $10,000 if they successfully sue someone involved in a procedure. And we'll take your phone calls here in a few moments. Line them up now at 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800 on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
Florida Senate President Wilton Simpson calls the Texas law, quote, a new approach, end quote. He says a similar measure will be introduced here in Florida. Simpson says he does not support financial incentives, though, for private citizens to report on those helping facilitate an abortion. We invited Senate President Simpson to join this program. He wasn't available. However, we're pleased to welcome John Stemberger, President and General Counsel with the Florida Family Policy Council. Thanks for joining us, John.
It's great to be with you.
So, do you support a Texas-style abortion law here in Florida?
I do. I think that this is something we should look at. I have some reservations. I like the private mechanism. You know, with civil rights laws, the government, it's not uncommon for the government to say, hey, there's no way we can enforce this through the Justice Department. And so we allow attorney's fees and cost so private litigants can, you know, enforce. So that's not something that's totally new, but in this area, it would certainly be new. The Supreme Court upheld a facial challenge, that is just looking at the face of the statute and saying this is okay. It doesn't involve state action. There's no criminal penalty here. There's no fine to the state. And because of that, the court said this is upheld and they would not enjoin the statute as being unconstitutional. But when and if it's applied, in other words, when someone goes and actually a private citizen attempts to attain the fine and sue the abortion, I think that is when there may be another challenge, and you might find that to be held unconstitutional. So it's an interesting creative thing, and I appreciate the creativity of the Texas statute, but I think in the end, it's probably going to be unconstitutional as it's applied in its effect.
Certainly the bounty provision in the Texas law is highly controversial, even among those who favor more restrictions on abortion. Do you have concerns that that could be divisive here in Florida if it's introduced in the state legislature?
You know, I don't know. I would call it a bounty. I mean, you have to show violations. So there would have to be a mother that has evidence that, you know, the doctor did not check to determine whether there's a heartbeat or a violation. I know in Texas right now, my counterpart tells me that most of the clinics are not doing abortions after 6 weeks. And they are complying with the law in Texas. I think eventually they may just ignore that and continue to do the abortions. And then you will see, actions being brought by private citizens and by women who feel like they've been harmed after the fact or something of that nature.
Let me ask you about public opinion on this. A Pew Research poll finds 56% of Florida residents support legal abortion in either all or most cases. What about concerns that further restricting access to abortion here in the Sunshine State would be out of step with a majority of the voters? There are already some restrictions on abortion here, we do need to note.
Yeah, I think the polling really depends upon how you frame the issue. I mean, our vision for this is that we need to be a society where we love children and not kill them. We need to be a society where adoption is always a better option. And when you frame things that way, you talk about the humanity of the unborn child, you get very different polling results than when you talk about restricting a woman's right to choose and her privacy. So a lot of the polling depends on how you frame the issue. And our vision is a positive vision where we want to see an end to abortion. We think it's unnecessary. And that, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of mothers and fathers going overseas to adopt children. And so if we can get women to have their children, have them adopted, it's just a much better option because the abortion is not only harmful and fatal to the child, it's also can be harmful to the woman as well.
John Stemberger, President, General Counsel with the Florida Family Policy Council, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Your phone calls coming up in just a few minutes. Also your tweets at Florida Roundup. Now, Florida Democratic lawmakers are expected to mount a vigorous defense against any new proposals to restrict abortion access here in the Sunshine State. We spoke on Thursday with Democratic Senator Annette Tadeo. Senator Tadeo, welcome back to Florida Public Radio. Do private citizens have the right to enforce abortion restrictions like they're asked to in the Texas law?
I find it abhorrent that we're even discussing this. Frankly, I do think that private citizens should not be turning in their fellow neighbors for what should be a very difficult but private decision between your doctor and your family and your God. Frankly, what Texas has done and what is being suggested to come to the state of Florida is the kind of vigilante attitude that we see in places like Cuba, where they have the neighborhood vigilantes that turn in their fellow neighbors to the regime. And that is, in essence, what they did with this law. They are rewarding neighbors when they turn in people that in their estimation are doing something that they shouldn't be doing, which again, the termination of a pregnancy is something that we should be working to end and to have minimal need for, but that's not what we're doing. What we're doing is just turning this into a political game with people's lives.
Do citizens have the right to do it? You call it abhorrent. You clearly don't agree with it, but do they have the ability to do it? Do neighbors have a constitutional ability to follow the kinds of reporting that are allowed under the Texas law?
I would hope that it's unconstitutional in the sense that we do have laws in this country about the privacy of your medical decisions. So I think it contradicts. Even we have HIPAA laws. I mean, there are so many things that when we go to the doctor, they have to make sure that your information is private. And in this case, we're actually talking about neighbors or taxi drivers, Uber, Lyft drivers. People can turn them in because they drove somebody to a place. And by the way, many women go to a Planned Parenthood like I did when I was younger and couldn't afford insurance to do their regular health care because that is their doctor and the only place they can afford to do it. Just because you go to some of these places doesn't mean that you're terminating a pregnancy. There are many other reasons to go visit.
Sure. And the law does not have residents turn in women for visiting a doctor, but rather specifically for an abortion procedure. You also mentioned HIPAA, which is the Federal Health Information Privacy Law, which protects the health information of any individual, allows the individual to disclose health information for themselves, but for no one else. The day after the Supreme Court did not take the action against the Texas law, you tweeted, quote, "The right to choose is under attack. Roe v. Wade is in jeopardy. We can't idly stand by and let it happen," end quote. What options do you have to pursue if legislation similar to the Texas law is proposed for the Florida legislature?
Frankly, very few options, because we are underrepresented, although the state is clearly pretty much 50-50 and the elections in Florida statewide tend to be close elections for the most part.
You mean Democrats in the legislature?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Democrats do not have the numbers. We do not have the numbers to stop this if this is what, and clearly it is, what the leadership in the Republican Party and the governor decide that they want to do, which is the reason why I think it's really important for people to understand how important it is for the public to get engaged, for people to get involved, and let their legislators know that this law, it should not come to Florida and we do not welcome it. And frankly, I can't believe that we're even discussing it, but that is the reality of politics today, unfortunately.
Do you think that if a Texas-style law was proposed by your fellow lawmakers, which it's expected to come in at least through the Florida House, do you expect that to pass the legislature? And I ask that question because in the last session, the Florida House passed a bill banning doctors from performing an abortion if they knew or should know the procedure was requested only because the fetus was showing signs of disabilities. That bill did not get a hearing in the Florida Senate and died on your side of the chamber.
Well, I can tell you that usually in the Senate, we tend to be the grown-ups. We tend to be the place where many of us have built relationships across the aisle and are able to kill certain bills. But when you hear the president of the Senate suggest that this is a bill that they're already working on, it lets you know that it's coming from leadership. And that is when it's much, much more difficult. And I know there were bills passed this last session that there were, I would say, a handful of senators on the Republican aisle that had to hold their nose and vote for it because leadership told them to, but not necessarily that they were in agreement.
Senator, you have reportedly been considering running for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. How does the possibility of this type of Texas-style abortion legislation in Florida impact your planning?
Well, if anything, it pushes you further towards it because it clearly shows how extreme our politics have gotten, and Florida's just not there. And we don't have a balance at all. I have been very thoughtful in my decision process, and for a reason. I really think it's a very big decision, but also because I want to make sure that the support is there. And I wanted to see if the other candidates that were in the race would pick up the steam that one needs to pick up to win a primary.
Those other primary candidates now are the current Agriculture Commissioner, Nikki Fried, and Democratic Congressman, former Governor Charlie Crist. Do you think that they have picked up the speed on this particular issue? You said that this issue does push you more toward a campaign for the Democratic nomination. What say you about the current Democratic candidates right now for governor? 30.
Look, I think that all of us on the issues agree. And so it is a matter of just trying to figure out who's going to be the best messenger to push back and to ultimately beat the incumbent governor. And I do think that it would be important to have a strong voice pushing back.
Democratic Senator Annette Tedeo. Senator Tedeo, thanks for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
What are your thoughts, Florida? 305-995-1800. Alexandra on the line from Clearwater, Florida. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi. I just want to say that this bill in Texas is clearly an assault on women, in particular poor women, because we all know that the rich will always get what they need, whether they have to go out of state or whatever it is, and the poor women will suffer. In terms of the fetal heartbeat issue, it's a misnomer. I heard it on NPR that is not a medical term, and they can't really detect that. It's very difficult to detect a fetal heartbeat.
You're right. At 6 weeks, you're right. It is not technically a heartbeat. You're right, Alexandra, about that, and I want to thank you for pointing that out. Thanks for that call. Lots of calls from around the state. Daniela in Boca Raton. Hey, Daniela, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, hi. I actually agree with your last person on the tender there. And my comment is that actually, based on the anatomy of a woman at 6 weeks, it's normal for some to not even have your period. And I find the hypocrisy of these Republican males who are trying to put this law or pass this law, like the one in Texas, when they have nothing to do with. I am not pro-abortion. However, I believe that is a decision that needs to be taken by the women and with their doctor or God. And there's no man that needs to be really involved, especially not in the legislation.
Thanks for your thoughts. That's Daniela in South Florida. Lots of tweets. Here's one. How is the Texas law not a violation of patient privacy? Doesn't HIPAA protect those treatments? Lots of calls, too. Mimi on the line from Tampa, Florida. Hey, Mimi.
Yes, hi. Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just had to call, pull over, and when the gentleman that was just speaking said that adoption is an option, I just have one question. How expensive is adoption for a family to make in the United States? If it was a simple process, okay, of course, it's valid to say. But it is not simple to adopt a child in the United States. And that is why people go overseas and adopt other children. And we have so many children in the foster system. I just cannot. I had to say that. There is absolutely no way that he can say, oh, adoption is an option. Because you're right, ma'am. The person that is getting this adoption, that is getting this abortion, sorry, I'm so upset, is clearly in a state of mind. I don't understand how people can say that. It's not an option for a lot of people to do adoption. If it was, clearly we wouldn't have all these children in foster system and the ability to, you know. So,
yeah, certainly a lot of red tape in this country over adopting. Thank you for that, Mimi. One more call, Peg in Auburndale. Hi, Peg.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Ever since the bill that had to do with a parent's bill of rights, I haven't read the bill myself, but I do know that it has to do with leaving the management of your child's health to the parent. However, when a woman does become pregnant at anywhere along the gestational period, she is a parent. But the Bill of Rights, does it not give me the right, if I were pregnant, to manage the health care of my unborn child? There's a definite rub between the two, and I just don't understand it. And it would be good to know that other people have the same thoughts about this.
You know, I thank you for those thoughts, Peg. And We have more people waiting on hold wanting to weigh in on this, but we are coming up against a break. Lots of people tweeting the show about this, particularly about the bounty provision, as it's been called, of the Texas law. Whether that comes to pass in the legislature here, we'll continue to follow here on the Florida Roundup. Still to come, the Florida leader of the extremist group, the Proud Boys, is now behind bars. His story next. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, he was once described as just a regular Miami kid. But now, Proud Boys leader Enrique Terrio is behind bars. He joins the ranks of dozens of Florida residents being prosecuted in the aftermath of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Unfortunately, this state, Tom, has more suspects from that insurrection attempt than any other.
Indeed. Now, just 2 months ago, Terrio had pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges of destruction of property and attempting to possess a high-capacity ammunition magazine in a pair of incidents dating back to December of 2020, before the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. That December situation was when members of Proud Boys burned a Black Lives Matter flag in Washington, D.C. Terrio returned to the nation's capital a month later and was caught carrying firearm parts in his backpack. So let's talk about this extremist group, the designation of a hate group to the Proud Boys, and with its Florida-based leader in prison for several months. 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. Share your thoughts on Twitter. We're at Florida Roundup.
Joshua Ceballos has been covering this case. He's a staff writer for the Miami New Times. Also with us, Freddie Cruz, analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Joshua, let's begin with you. How did Enrique Terrio become leader of the Proud Boys? How was he radicalized?
Am I coming in okay? Can you hear me?
Yes, sure can.
Okay, so Enrique joined the Proud Boys in 2017 after meeting another Proud Boy, Alex Gonzalez, at a party in Miami for Milo Yiannopoulos. He joined and kind of quickly rose through the ranks of leadership through connections that he had in the political sphere, and I think also a good bit of charisma that he's got. And just organizing events, he became the so-called zone lead for the 6th zone in Florida for the Proud Boys, and then became co-president of the Vice City chapter, which is the Miami chapter of the Proud Boys. And eventually in 2018, when Proud Boys founder and vice co-founder Gavin McInnes stepped down from the Proud Boys following a violent altercation in New York, there was a power vacuum, and Enrique eventually ran for the chairman position, and he won unanimously and became leader of the Proud Boys in 2018.
Now, as Tom said, he will be spending some time behind bars, but not a lot of time. Is that right?
That's correct. So he'll be in there for 155 days, just about 5 months. And then he's got 3 years of probation after that.
How did he change the organization? What was his impact on this hate group?
So initially, the Proud Boys, I described it in my story on Miami New Times as a politically incorrect men's club. They labeled themselves as just a drinking social club for men, although that could be argued that it had a little bit more hateful rhetoric in the beginning. But when Enrique came in, he really pushed it into a more political direction, trying to get them involved politically. They became like a de facto security force for a lot of Republican and right-wing candidates throughout the country. And they continue to have that role to this day, kind of inserting themselves into hot-button political topics.
Freddie Cruz, let's go to you. The Southern Poverty Law Center does call the Proud Boys, among many other extremist organizations, a hate group. Enrique Tarrio, one of dozens of suspects in the state arrested in connection with attempts to overthrow the government. In fact, Florida's number one, unfortunately. 10% of those suspects come from here. You track this. Tell us how this case fits into the overall trend in Florida. This state has become a hotbed of right-wing radicalism and also denying the validity of the 2020 election. If you could unmute yourself,
yeah,
Freddie.
You.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, so I think this really stems back to, so SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, typically, we monitor these kinds of hate and extremist groups. In our last UN hate report, which we published back around February, we basically outlined how hate and extremism has essentially seeped into the mainstream with these really, fringe movements like QAnon, these concepts like Stop the Steal. And of course, we saw a lot of activity in the state of Florida, where Florida this past year had the second highest number of, hate and extremist groups present in the state. And of course, out of the insurrection, we're also seeing a high number of individuals being charged. This includes folks like the Proud Boys, where their home base is located in Florida. But you also see groups like the Oath Keepers have a really significant presence in this space of like extremism and hate. And it really speaks volumes to just how these sort of concepts and ideas have essentially melded into what we consider to be, general mainstream politics, where a lot of, in some cases, even just elected representatives are spewing concepts that stem from fringe ideas like the QAnon movement, these ideas of civil liberties coming from like Boogaloo movements. So it's quite scary.
We are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Talk about the ramifications of that, Freddie. How this weakens our system of government, weakens our democracy, and why the SPLC continues to track these groups and tries to warn the public about them.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that we specifically focus a lot on, and we've been sort of putting a lot of energy into, is tracking these anti-government extremist organizations that tend to spew conspiracy theories that essentially try and question the legitimacy of not only the federal government, but also state governments. Traditionally, it was a lot of, the anti-government movement was very much focused at the federal level, trying to demonize and, question the legitimacy of federal institutions and agencies like the Bureau of Land Management, like the FBI. But most recently, with this past presidential election, we also saw a lot of extremist groups turn their attention to state governments as well as state-level representatives, Democratic governors, mayors. We saw a lot of protesting, especially with COVID-19 and the spur of Black Lives Matter rallies. A lot of these extremist groups capitalized on that with this idea of essentially casting doubt and making people question whether our democratic process is actually legitimate, all for political gain. And in some cases, like with the Proud Boys, they're essentially just grifters who are moving from issue to issue with this idea of you know, trying to rally up a base and trying to collect members for their organization.
Joshua, let me ask you, it's Tom Hudson. Let me ask you kind of that question that Freddie's alluding to. What has recruitment of the Proud Boys been like in Florida under Tario's leadership?
So based on my interviews with Tario, particularly after the stand back, stand by comment from Donald Trump during the first presidential debate last September, recruitment shot up. They suddenly had a flood of new recruits who wanted to join because the president of the United States mentioned them by name and seemed to endorse them. So they got a lot of recruitment after that. And then after the January 6th insurrection, they also saw a new wave of recruitment as people kind of saw them as this high profile group that was involved, and people who supported the insurrection and see it as something that was righteous really wanted to join the Proud Boys. So it's been, if anything, this has just been good publicity for them.
Well, and Freddie, you talk about some of these extremist and hate groups turning their attention to kind of state and local politics. And in fact, Joshua, Tario has expressed interest in public office himself, hasn't he?
That's correct. So in 2020, he ran for Donna Shalala's seat in Florida. That campaign kind of petered out because he couldn't gain campaign donations due to some issues with credit card processing. He plans to run for local office again, he tells me, once he's out of jail, probably for a city or county commission seat. And the Proud Boys are at a lot of local political events like the anti-mask protests at the school board.
Here, I have one for both of you. With the continuing prosecutions of people who took part in January 6th, how is that affecting groups like the Proud Boys here in Florida, membership and their overall strength?
I can start. Mm-hmm. I think the continued prosecutions has kind of, I think, made them a little bit more wary, at least the Proud Boys. They, to my understanding, they're planning to restructure things in a way that's a little bit more secretive, and they're being a little bit more careful with their communications because in large part they've been kind of open on like Telegram, social media apps like Telegram, announcing what they're doing. And Tario, as spokesman, has openly spoken to media, but I think now they're a little bit on alert and probably being a little bit more cloak and dagger because of all these prosecutions.
Joshua Ceballos, what are you seeing in Miami?
What do you mean?
With Enrique Tario's arrest and imprisonment, has that affected the overall vitality of a hate group like the Proud Boys?
Well, so before the sentencing and before he went into jail, they had already kind of been splintering over some internal conflicts, partly to do with Enrique Tario's status as an informant for the government after a previous case in around 2012, 2013. But I think from the communications that I've been able to see, it seems like they're kind of rallying around him and the other Proud Boys who are currently incarcerated after January 6th as sort of, you could say, possibly martyr figures. And it might even, in my opinion, strengthen them a little bit.
I'd encourage everyone to read your work, Joshua Ceballos, writing about this for the Miami New Times. Thanks also to Freddie Cruz. He's an analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project Tracking Hate Groups. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Andrea Padermo are producers. Catherine Hobbs is our associate producer. Chris Remington helped with production this week.
WLRN's Director of Radio Operations and the program's Technical Director is Peter Meritz. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon.